From Studio A in Podcast Village, Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., this is the best political talk show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics with your host and moderator, Justin Russell. Hello out there in Radio Land. It is time for the best political podcast you've never downloaded. We really got to go with that. Anyway, I'm your host and moderator, Justin Russell. Joining me in studio, he is the former Assistant Secretary for International Trade at the Department of Commerce. He is the one we know as the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Justin.
And joining us from a remote, undisclosed location in the Bay State of Massachusetts, he is the renowned author of such books as American Politics on the Rocks. He is the one we know as Rich Rubino. Hello, Rich.
Hello, Justin.
Behind the glass is Rob the Engineer, keeping us honest as always. And somewhere out in the hinterlands of the nation's capital is our producer, Eric Thomas. Hopefully Dan Lippener will join us later. Hey, you know, there's a lot of going on, but the want to start off this episode with the absolute tragedy that's happening in the eastern part of Syria, the northern part of Iraq, the area that we know as Kurdish Syria, Kurdish Iraq, or if you are supportive of the Kurds, the sovereign country of Kurdistan. If you recall, we discussed in one of our last episodes last week about how President Trump had announced that he was pulling all troops out of the region, out of the Kurdish region, which pretty much took hits from all politicians and military experts in Washington on both sides of the aisle. The president stood fast and continued to push that agenda, and then over the weekend and into this week, we are getting just horrid stories of what can only, I guess, be called, Alan Moore, war crimes, genocide, possibly. I mean, this is...
Well, we can call it mayhem right now.
Okay. The reports coming out of Kurdistan are just not pretty at all.
There's an extra 150,000 or so civilians already displaced on the march, mostly women and children.
Yeah. Last week, if you recall, we talked to the Washington bureau chief of Kurdistan, K24, the Kurdistan TV network that was here in Washington, and he was getting ready to go to Erbil. I have since talked to Raheem Rashidi while he's been in Erbil, and again, it is not a pretty, it's not a pretty picture coming out of that region. Alan, let me start with you. Number one, we'll get into the politics and everything on this, but we've seen video of allegedly. I mean, these videos have not been confirmed, but I saw one video of what looked like Turkish militia under Turkish military command field executing Kurdish rebels and other Kurds. These are visions that we were afraid of that I guess the White House didn't take into consideration. Did they misjudge this?
Well, they clearly misjudged. And it's in fairness to all the people who work in the White House, in the National Security Council, and in the agencies of government that provide input, particularly the State Department, Defense Department, CIA, it appears that most people who have been involved in providing input and advice have had this vision of what would occur, and it turns out that they were right. You will recall that a year ago, when the president announced rather abruptly and without the kind of comprehensive conversation you would expect that he was going to fully pull U.S. troops out of Syria, that Jim Mattis, the well-respected Secretary of Defense, said, "I've had enough. I'm leaving." And he didn't blast the administration, but it was clearly over that issue. In fairness to any administration, the situation in northern Syria and northern Iraq and southern Turkey is very complicated. And the Turks have been basically at war with the Kurds, an organization in Turkey called the PKK, that is designated by the United States government and the Turks and others as a terrorist organization.
Let me just jump in on that question, though, because you bring up a very valid point. Has there been just an inherent hypocrisy on the fact that when the Peshmerga, Kurds, are literally the pointy end of the spear in fighting ISIS in the region, they are our allies. We stand toe-to-toe with them, and yet, at the same time, we push back when Turkey gives us a hassle, and we continue to recognize the PKK as a terrorist organization. Is there a hypocrisy there?
Well, I don't know whether hypocrisy is the right word. The problem was, and it started with President Obama, he's the one that decided to get in bed, if you will, with the Kurds down in Syria, who are apparently, reportedly, affiliated with the PKK. So they're part of the same group that the Turkish government has been at odds with and literally at war with for a couple of decades. So they're not thought of as terrific guys. Having said that, they turned out to be great fighters and great allies in the effort to get rid of ISIS. Now, it wasn't because they thought, we want to be like America. It's because they were fighting for their homeland.
Right.
And here were Americans who were giving them some credibility and some arms and some economic support. So it was an awkward marriage, if you will, because they were not the best guys. And this was known in the Obama administration, and the Trump administration inherited that. And President Trump, I have no idea how much of that he even understands. He probably gets a nugget or two here, like, oh, they're not great guys. And the president says, and I want to get out of Syria anyway. I campaigned on it. So why don't we get out of here? Well, gee, Mr. President, we've got about 1,000 troops there. And if we pull out, chances are there will be a massive bloodbath,
but Rich Rubino,
a bigger war than we've got now.
Right. But Rich Rubino, this is a situation that goes even further back than the Obama administration. I mean, we counted on Kurdish support during Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And when we did not go in to Baghdad at the order of then-President George H.W. Bush, a lot of the Kurds back then, again, Kurdish forces that we relied on in the north to help thwart Iraqi aggression in the region, we backed out of there and let Saddam Hussein just go in there and run ramshot over them. And this is going back 30 years.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was the Bush administration basically kind of goaded them, go to the Kurds, do some sort of an uprising, and a lot of the Kurds essentially thought the United States would back them up, and they didn't, so essentially the Kurds were slaughtered in that. And that's why you always heard George W. Bush, when he was trying to make justification for going into Iraq in 2002, 2003, he would constantly say, you know, that they massacred the Kurds. Well, that's partly because we had goaded them to doing it, and then we never came in and protected them afterward. You know, what's interesting, though, about Donald Trump's promise, because it's true, when he campaigned in 2016, and this was in the Republican primary, and it was in part opposition to both the George W. Bush administration and Barack Obama's administration, he basically said that there were forever wars going back really to 9/11. Afghanistan and Iraq, though, were the two wars that most people knew about and the ones that Americans continuously started to oppose. Now, I mean, they generally favored them when we went in first in 2001 in Afghanistan, certainly had almost 90% support, but just kept lagging and lagging, and people were saying, why are the troops still there? And very few people actually thought when he was talking about getting troops out that he was referring to Syria. Or that he was referring to, you know, these 1,000 troops, for example. I don't know how many Americans, and I'd love to see a poll on this, actually knew we even had forces there. You know, we have forces in a lot of places. We have bases all around the world that very few people actually know about. So it's really curious that this is the place where he decides he's going to take troops out, where very few people even knew this was even going on. And I don't think anybody, from a political perspective, it would be hard for any Democrat to come in and say, you know, Donald Trump promised to take us out of these wars and then mention Syria. They talk about the fact that we're still in Afghanistan, maybe, something to that effect. And if we still had troops, if we still had a litany of troops in Iraq, you would say something to the effect of, well, we still have the same amount of troops we had under Obama that we have under Trump. And no one would have brought up Syria.
Right. But Alan Moore, you know, it seems to me that, you know, there's always been question as far as the motives of the president in dealing with some of these foreign policy decisions. The Democrats and even some in his party have already come out and said, you know, how are you making these rash decisions regarding Russia, regarding China, regarding other areas? The one with the decision making with Turkey and President Erdogan is kind of an odd one. Whereas Turkey is a NATO ally, do the interests of President Erdogan necessarily meet up or merge with or even coincide a little bit with the national security interests of the United States right now?
Well, you made the biggest point in describing them as a member of NATO. And as a member of NATO, they have obligations and the other countries of NATO have obligations to each other. Having said that, President Erdogan, who has been in power now for
a long time,
has amassed an enormous amount of power and has chosen in many instances to kind of go his own way, to thumb his nose not only at America, but to some extent at NATO, putting a lot of tension on the NATO alliance. One of the criticisms of the president in this recent move, there's so many, but President Erdogan for the entire Trump presidency has said, just want you to know, we have to go in to northern Syria and clear out an area to create a buffer zone and get some control over this group that's affiliated with our mortal enemy here, the PKK, this other group of Kurds. And we've also got a million refugees, and we want to put them into that buffer zone. They're creating a whole host of problems on our side of the border. We want to move them back across the border, provide some level of protection, et cetera. Now, the president doesn't get briefed. He doesn't pay attention. He doesn't have any sense of history or show any interest in it. So he's basically thinking, oh, what you say makes sense. He trusts his own instincts. And that's why a year ago he was on the verge. Well, he said, we're going to pull out of Syria. And Mattis basically said, okay.
But at that same press conference, he also said at that same press conference that we will always support and we are friends of the Kurdish people and the Peshmerga. And they fought side by side with us. They are our brothers in arms.
The thing is, you can't have these things both ways in that kind of simplistic way. It's nuanced. It's challenging. What we were able to do for the last 2 years, particularly a year ago after the president announced we were pulling out of Syria, and then Lindsey Graham, among others, but particularly Lindsey Graham, said, Mr. President, you cannot do this. All hell is going to break loose. Mattis is gone over this. And the president, which he hates to do, changed his mind and left this contingent of overseers. They're in harm's way, but they're not actually engaged in direct combat. They're providing a lot of support and oversight and information and so on, and it, not to mention all the equipment that we have. So what he needed to do this time, first of all, is probably not pick up the phone. Two, do some briefings before he got on with Erdogan. Three, not follow his gut instinct, which was to say, fine, let's get out of there. And it wasn't 1,000 troops in the beginning. It was more like 50.
50,
no, 50 people to move out of the area on Sunday night, when all the bombing and shelling and movement of troops was going on. The decision was made, we got to get all of our folks, all 1,000 or so, to a safe place.
Right. And Rich Rubino, you know, this literally plays into the hands of every one of our adversaries in the region. Right now, we've got reports saying that the Kurdish transitional government in Erbil has struck a deal with Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, who we were trying to get out of there originally because of his questionable human rights and questionable crimes against his own people. Now, our allies, the Peshmerga and the Kurds, have made a deal with them, which plays right into the hands of Vladimir Putin and the Russians. And now we get word today that the Russians are on patrol in this part of Syria at the request of the Syrians at the request of the Kurds. Did we get played in a foreign policy mess up by Putin and Russia, who's going to have a bigger slice of an already unstable region for us?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Putin seems to benefit from quite a lot from U.S. policy. if I was a conspiracy theorist, I would say that there was some sort of a that there was some sort of an agreement here, some sort of a plot. But no, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, you know, it certainly benefits Putin, and it benefits certainly his sphere of influence. Remember, that was one thing. You know, Vladimir Putin was certainly a supporter of Assad, and part of the reason why Assad is still in power in Syria. I remember the Obama administration essentially wanted to dislodge him from power, but Vladimir Putin was essentially saying that he needs to stay into power. You know, we've always had these kind of issues with the Russians. You know, going back, for example, I know they were very there was a lot of animosity when we went into Kosovo, for example, because that was their cradle province. So yeah, I mean, I think that certainly this does play into the hands of Vladimir Putin, but. You know, you wonder after listening to, for example, the prank phone call that Lindsey Graham got from the alleged foreign minister. You know, he basically hints at the fact that there was something here where involving Trump's hotels. And it's also interesting when you listen to that call specifically and you listen to Lindsey Graham talking. Lindsey Graham does not seem to make the same cases. You know, nationally, he's always the hawk. He's always wants to support the Kurds. But when he talks here, he's essentially saying that, yeah, you know, Turkey has some problem. You have some problems with the Kurds. It's just interesting to see that he kind of takes the opposite position. If you're a conspiracy theorist, you would say that somehow Trump and Putin are somehow working together on this, and that somehow the hotels are involved. But of course, we have no, you know, it's all circumstantial evidence in many respects.
So, Alan Moore, I've talked to friends of ours at the State Department, inside Department of Defense. It was reported last week that Turkish forces had been firing on areas very close to American positions that were providing security support for the detention of known ISIS combatants. I bring this up because in talking to my friends, they are very concerned that our pullout of the region not only unstabilizes the region, but literally lights a fuse under the reestablishment and the rebirth of a bigger, angrier ISIS. Do you see their concern?
Well, it is certainly one of the principal concerns that has been on the table in the briefing books, in the minds of senior advisors. Now, before we simply say that what a great win for Putin this is, if you look at the history of the region and the history of the U.S. alliance with these Kurds, who basically joined up with us, it was a marriage of convenience for them. They got economic support, weapons support, logistical support, some guidance, and a fair amount of credit. It was a controversial move, as I said earlier, when we did it with President Obama. We're seeing now, in part, that it was fraught with tension, challenge, difficulty. Then we got Turkey over here, champing at the bit to go in and clean them out. We've got a president who doesn't have the sense, the knowledge, the instinct or the inclination, for that matter, to continue to do what we'd been doing. When Erdogan would say, "We got to go in there," you'd say, "If you go in, there will be significant major consequences, including the genuine possibility of sanctions, not just by America, but by all of NATO." You know, we're hearing so little about the rest of NATO, all of whom have arguably an even bigger interest than America because they're so close geographically.
The Brits have called what's happening currently in Kurdish Syria a absolute humanitarian tragedy.
Oh, they have.
The Italians have all come out against this.
Nobody's embracing it, but it's the kind of it's a situation that helps us understand why we have international alliances. We don't just move. I mean, with this president, he just moves and threatens. He doesn't say NATO. He says we. And if he could bring himself to lower himself in his mind and his view of sending his senior people around to say, We need a consolidated, collective response that will really, truly frighten Erdogan more than just the U.S.
Does it not look like at this point that this was foreign policy driven by the interests of President Erdogan and the Turkish government rather than what was in the best interests of the United States and the region as a whole? Well, to me, it looks like that we were appeasing a Trump landlord.
Well, yeah, I'm using hyperbole here,
but I mean, literally, this was foreign policy driven by Erdogan and his interests rather than the statable interests of our national security.
Well, here's the problem. It happens that what Erdogan has been wanting to do is something that in his gut, in his perfect gut, the president thinks is a good idea. He admires these autocrats. He thinks we can get out of there.
So who's running the foreign policy?
Those guys can go fight it out all they want, and we can stand aside and keep our guys out of harm's way without realizing that we and all of NATO has a massive stake in some level of stability in that area. So the president's instinct is to stand aside. He doesn't understand all of what Erdogan is doing. He doesn't understand the downside risk. He doesn't understand the need to consult, meet, understand. He doesn't understand the need even
to consult. But this plays right into Putin's playbook for dominance in the region.
Well, Putin, you know, is going to be a player. He's selling a bunch of equipment to the Turks on the one hand, but we're in a situation now where it's not inconceivable that, depending upon how many Russians are actually in the region supporting the side that is opposed to the Turks, that we could have Turkey, this sort of would-be potential part-time friend of Russia, killing Russians in the region. There's all sorts of potential for disaster here.
This is a nightmare scenario that you're coming up with. Rich Rubino, I mean, again, I pose the question, who in fact is running our foreign policy in the region right now? Because it seems to me that every time President Erdogan of Turkey just gets this inkling of, I'm going to run in and take care of this PKK problem, apparently all he has to do is call up Donald Trump and call up the White House and get what he wants.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly what it is. You know, Donald Trump does not seem to listen to many advisors, or potentially he will listen to somebody, some sort of an outside advisor.
But he'll listen to Erdogan.
For the United States, he will listen to advisors that have the pre-formulated view that he wants them to, that essentially that he has. He just wants somebody to verify him. He likes yes men. He likes people that will, he likes confirmation bias. He likes people that will essentially say, this is what you should do. This is how you should do it. This is how you should manipulate it. And if those are the people that either he likes them, whether he's watching Fox News and decides they're going to be advisors, or people that generally tend to agree with him, he tends to give them roles. He calls up, you know, like talking to Tucker Carlson, for example. That's the way this president operates. It's not the traditional, you know, it's not like President Johnson during Vietnam. He consulted a bunch of wise men. They were supposed wise men. They weren't so wise, but they came in and they told him, you know, this is what you have to do in Vietnam. So he says, I'm going to stay the course. In Donald Trump's case, he just listens to people that want to, people that agree with what he already essentially believes, what his hunch is. And that's essentially where he goes. Just like in the campaign, he said, I'm going to rely on my great brain. You know, he's not going to rely on foreign policy advisors. That's why I think in part General Mattis essentially resigned, because I think he thought when he was coming into the administration that he was going to be able to persuade the president to listen to his advisors, to somewhat at least tie a little bit to international alliances. He didn't do that. And he realized that Donald Trump relies simply on instincts. He doesn't rely on, you know, on certainly on analytics or anything or history or anything other than what he feels and how he feels something should be applied. And then once he makes a mistake, it's always a victory. You know, declare victory no matter what no matter how you fail, declare victory. And that's essentially how Donald Trump, you know, basically right. That's how he became. That's what he did in business. And that's what he did in politics, and it's different than any other president.
Alan Moore, the Secretary of Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, last week suggested that, though, there might be sanctions that we can put into place. And then yesterday it was stated that we're going to put sanctions into place for Turkey's actions in Syrian Kurdistan. Is this too little too late? Does this, because to me, sanctions are against individuals as punishment. What are we going to sanction against the Turkish military and the Turkish government?
Well, what he has said is that he will.
Other than he's threatened to destroy their economy.
Exactly.
Oh, come on.
And the way you do that, first and foremost, is you muck around with their financial system, their banks, and that is not yet that has not been talked about yet, which was in an odd way a sigh of relief to the markets. But he's talked about a 50% tariff on Turkish steel, and the Turks make some steel,
right.
and they ship some to America, and a variety of other economic moves. More interestingly, the Volkswagen, the German company, yesterday, in light of everything going on, said they were postponing a final decision on whether to build
a
$1.2 billion factory in Turkey.
Right.
Now, these kinds of things are bigger deals, but they speak to this point and the need to and benefit of talking to our allies about what we can do together to apply economic pressure. I mean, Erdogan, he's got his own views. He's got political imperatives. He's accumulated an enormous amount of power. He sees this opportunity. The president has always been, even though he had to be shored up by the people around him, a major sticking point. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, 10 days ago, the president says, okay, we'll move our guys. And then the president has three or four different narratives after the fact,
and by the way,
to explain what he is and is not doing.
Because I didn't want to turn this into an hour-long discussion. Literally the same week that he talks about pulling out of Syria, he talks about putting in another 1,500 or I'm sorry, another 10,000.
I think it's 1,800.
1,800 troops into
Saudi Arabia. Yep.
All right. I don't get it. With that, we're going to take a break. We're going to continue to monitor the situation. Follow us on Twitter. We're staying in contact with our friends who are embedded in Kurdistan. Real quickly, Alan Moore.
The thing that's particularly interesting from a political standpoint right now is how many Republicans have ventured forth to be critical of this decision.
Including Mitch McConnell.
And tonight we got Democrats in a debate, and we'll see what they have to say.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that in another episode.
John Kempkins from Illinois said he won't endorse him now for 2020.
Oh, gee, yeah. Okay. Yeah. He needs a lot more than that. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about another serious political and humanitarian crisis that might be happening. That's the situation in Hong Kong and China. And we're going to talk about the China trade deal, phase one, part A, subsection 1D. That's when we come back. This is Backroom Politics.
the way I feel today. My heart is aching because he's making a plaything of my devotion. That's the way I feel today. Without any reason or a word to say, that man turned his keys in and he packed and went away. What good is living? I'll soon be giving my body up to the ocean. That's the way I feel today. I said, that's the way I feel today.
From Studio A in Podcast Village, Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., this is the best political talk show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics with your host and moderator, Justin Russell.
And apparently we've had a pitching change inside the booth. Management has relieved Rob the Engineer, and we've got our host and proprietor of Podcast Village, Charlie Burney, working the boards. And Rob the Engineer is doing engineering stuff, actually. That's cool. Joining us in studio right now is our friend and Democratic political operative and bar-certified attorney in the great state of Maryland and the District of Columbia, Dan Lipner. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Justin.
Can we get you anything? Fries, napkins?
Well, you know, I a little bit of munchies because I was going after Rudy's drug dealer, but I didn't realize a metaphorical drug dealer.
I was just waiting for you to say, we have the meats. Trademark copyright. You don't
want that one? No.
Yeah, okay. Okay. We're going to talk about another serious situation that's happening. And it's kind of tied in with another situation that we're still trying to get our hands wrapped around. So over the past few days, there has been talk that a trade deal between the United States and China had been put into place. And when I say trade deal, I mean some sort of tentative Part One agreement, what the president is calling phase one of a bigger China trade deal. It was announced Friday that this thing had come into play. More news was coming out over the weekend. This is both leaders, both in Beijing and here in Washington, were facing mounting pressure to unscrew this trade war that's been happening between the United States and China. Trump has said, it has been said that Trump had been increasing pressure on Beijing with higher tariffs. Beijing would follow suit and just questionably make economic maneuvers inside their central banks and central government. It is been reported that both sides decided that half a deal was better than none. But now that the details are coming out about this quote-unquote deal, it doesn't look like as great a deal for us as it does China. Alan Moore, as former Assistant Secretary of Commerce.
Undersecretary
of Commerce. I always say assistant, don't I?
I sometimes let it pass. Oh. I actually had four of those working for me.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. You were the Assistant Secretary of Commerce.
The Undersecretary.
The Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. That's what I was getting at. You look at this deal as what's being reported. Do you agree with some in Wall Street that this is not a deal we should be bragging about just yet?
There's nothing to brag about on either side.
How so?
There's not much there. So recall where we were. We were on the verge of increasing the 25% tariff on about $250 billion worth of trade.
That was going to go up to 30.
It was going to go to 30 on October 15th.
Right.
So what the biggest harm that the Chinese have done to a particular sector in America is our farm sector, and in the farm sector, most particularly soybeans. They eat and consume massive quantities of soybeans. Asians all over the place do. Think soy sauce and tofu, just for starters. And the U.S. grows fabulous soybeans of all different varieties and qualities and types.
Right. Anyway.
And that industry has been devastated by the Chinese move, and it's particularly painful if you're a soybean producer, and in certain parts of the country,
if you're a family farmer,
that raises soybeans, there aren't a lot of family farmers much anymore. But there's some, and they're kind of big wealthy families if they still are in the farming business. But it's a very important part of the economy in some of the heartland, and so if you think about where we are. We've got these tariffs on all these Chinese products, which simply mean that U.S. consumers have to pay more for those products. Now, to some extent, if we can substitute out what used to be made in China and buy the same thing for a similar price in India or Vietnam, for a couple of examples, or Pakistan, then maybe you do some harm besides the tariffs. We buy less, or maybe we buy the same amount, we buy it elsewhere. It's a lot easier to substitute grains and farm products,
right,
like soybeans, and you've got Brazil burning down the Amazon so that it can convert forest to cattle for a year or two and then plant soybeans. And Brazil has become the major substitute soybean supplier to China.
So explain to me this phase one half deal, because what I'm reading doesn't look like we've changed anything. It looks like a large shell game replacing agricultural buys and reducing tariffs on agricultural buys with tariffs on hard industrialized goods.
Iffy agricultural buys. They're not guarantees.
Well, that's true, but
there's no detail. There's no detail in this. So the prime
shouldn't
the
that primary, give us concern?
Well, the reason the market reacted was because we're going to postpone the increase in the tariffs that were due October 15th. We got some more coming up in December. Okay,
those are the industrialized
those
goods.
Those are the new pressure point.
Right.
Those are some additional product, and we've got this really major problem in the farm sector of the U.S. So the Chinese were going to come, and then they weren't going to come, and then they came, and there were a couple of days of conversations. The principal negotiator for the Chinese is a deputy premier.
Right.
It's not the Minister of Commerce. It's a deputy premier. He was here.
Right.
He's a big, big deal. So it's important when he comes. And there were some general understandings, extreme lack of detail, a non-binding commitment to increase the purchases of agricultural product, and an agreement not to impose the next phase.
So they sent Pence over to try and make the deal.
Those were the big items in this. It was not worthy of an Oval Office meeting in the minds of most, but the one person who mattered the most was the president, who kind of insisted that everybody come in. People saw the reports, and the president talked about this as the greatest, as he is wont to do, one of the greatest trade deals in the history of the world, the greatest agriculture buy ever, et cetera. And it's not. But it's not.
It's not right now. Dan Lipner.
So that's actually the point. There are a couple of things, and this also includes what was happening with Turkey and the Kurds. The president is playing his shell game of hide my scandal with something else, except I don't think he was betting that people who knew what they were doing or something else more dramatic would happen based on those decisions. In both cases, the president was shouting from the mountaintops about his successes, but the only people that are listening are the choir.
But the funny thing about it is,
or at least saying it's a success.
It's a shrinking choir.
It's a shrinking choir. But Rich Rubino, you know, it's funny because a friend of mine who's an economist down south was telling me that he equated this trade announcement with China as really, really expensive jazz hands, that you know, he there's nothing to it, but if you look at it long enough, it looks amazing. Are we literally getting into a situation where we are literally placating our economic security for a headline?
I don't know. Well, I mean, I don't know in terms of we. I think specifically for Donald Trump, the answer is yes. I think that he underestimated, I think, the implications of the trade war specifically with China. I think he's running for re-election in 2020, and the last thing he wants is farmers and people who had supported him in 2016 saying that essentially that we can no longer sell our products to China because of this trade war, and he wants somehow to be able to declare, you know, it's like George Aiken said during the Vietnam War, he says declare victory and go home. That's essentially what I think his strategy is. He's going to view this and he's going to say essentially, you know, I came in here, as he said, I'm the chosen one. I was supposed to essentially deal with this whole China problem, but no other president, the other presidents just kicked the can down the road. I'm the one who essentially said, I'm the one who stopped the can and said, we're going to essentially solve this problem right now. He's going to say, you know, he's going to say, we negotiated with the Chinese. We have an agreement. He's going to declare victory. He's going to go home and he's going to run for re-election. And that's going to be one of his things is that he won the trade war with China. Not saying that he actually did win the trade war with China, but of course, perception is reality. In Donald Trump's mind, he's going to try to make that the perception amongst the American electorate.
Dan Lipner?
Right, but the American electorate aren't the only people at play here, or I should say, the macro electorate aren't the only people at play. The micro electorate, meaning the people who actually make their incomes from farming, who have been hurt at some point. Those markets will have permanently shifted, as Alan was correctly pointing out, that other people are trying to step in to fill the void. And once you've developed those trade relationships, it's not necessarily the easiest thing to shift back.
Right. You know, the thing about it is also an interesting statement coming out of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, Alan Moore, was that by the end of 2020, this trade war could cost the global economy $700 billion, which is basically the equivalent of the economy of Switzerland. That is a big number over a measuring game that we really don't need to be playing right now. It doesn't just affect us, is what I'm saying.
I think that loses the ball because we're not talking about the.
And by the way, he's Alan Moore.
No, I understand that, but I actually have an issue with the question.
Why?
Because the United States, in theory, the President of the United States and Donald Trump, he came into office saying he was going to fight for the interests of the American people, in this case, the American farmers and American manufacturing. So keeping our eye on that ball. Is there any proof that American manufacturing and American farming are benefiting from this? I think the pretty clear answer is no. On top of that, because of how the Chinese are handling it and Donald Trump not understanding that you need allies both domestically and internationally to win these fights.
But I think you're missing the point on the fact that, you know, this pissing match between Beijing and Washington is literally going to have a $700 billion global impact on the economy.
Tell the Brazilian Beijing farmers that are now making money out of the deal.
Well, that you also have to tell our partners in Canada, in Mexico, we're trying to get this, you know, NAFTA 2.0 through, mm-hmm. And if we're sucking it because of our measuring game with China. This does not just affect us. It affects the global economy. If it affects, let's say, Sweden, it's a difference between Volvo opening a plant outside of Charleston, South Carolina, or not.
Right. But in the game of brinksmanship that Donald Trump was going to play.
Is there really brinksmanship here?
Well, that's the thing. That Donald Trump, I mean, I've said this from the get-go, that Donald Trump has given away everything he's had for bargaining leverage from the beginning of his presidency. Even though it was an incorrect argument, his argument about the Chinese manipulating their currency, he gave away about 15 minutes into his presidency. If you're going to use these rhetorical attacks or substantive attacks to win a fight, you have to use the leverage somewhere. You can't just give it away for nothing. And that's what he's consistently been doing.
But Alan Moore, what Dan's describing is that the president believes that he's playing on house money. Is he, in fact, playing on house money?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question here, but,
all right, let me put it into perspective. It seems to me that this that the president feels like he ultimately has the upper hand in any discussion that we're having with Beijing, regardless of the economic impact it's going to have globally. Let me rephrase the question this way. Does President Trump understand that going inch for inch with Beijing could have a direct impact on a peripheral impact on our economy? Like, as I explained to Dan, if Sweden's economy goes south, does Volvo build that $1.2 billion factory outside China? Does Kubota build that $2 billion factory outside of Omaha?
So these decisions are, you know, multi-years in the making. The problem here is that we have a president who thinks that who measures trade deals on the basis of country to country by country trade deficits. If you have a surplus with a country, you're doing well. If you have a deficit, you're doing lousy. That's his definitional sort of brainless approach to this, which has got him into trouble forever because we have a massive trade deficit with China. And in his mind, they're taking us to the cleaners, and we have to fix that.
But now, in his mind, we also have a trade deficit with Canada, which we don't.
I'm just saying, you know, we used to have, and we still have some trade deficit with oil producing countries. They sold us oil. We wanted their oil. We bought it. They didn't buy anything much from us, and we bought a lot of oil from them because we needed it. We buy what we need, and we sell what we can. And in the case of China, however, and we've been over this many times, we had some very bad habits emerge. We were cutting deals with the Chinese that had short-term gain and long-term challenges. And Donald Trump had a point. He just doesn't understand what he's talking about. He picks up the talking point without really understanding what the talking point means when he says, it's up to me to fix all this stuff. Well, if you asked him what are 10 problems that we have with China, he would come back with the massive surplus that they have. He would not be able to talk in any intelligible way about intellectual property and stealing our ideas, counterfeiting stuff, copycatting stuff, and cutting deals with the likes of Boeing and Caterpillar, if you will, and auto companies where they will build cars there and they will gain access to our production and design techniques. Giving up very little. We made some bad deals. Well, you don't fix that in 20 minutes or a long weekend of conversation. You apply pressure. You go to our allies. You bring others in who have also been used or allowed themselves to be used.
Well, we have no credibility with our allies. Well, How do we bring them in?
Well, this is the problem, that all the opportunity, all the normal way that you would do these kinds of international agreements, the president ignored from the get-go because he thought that he was so brilliant and so powerful because of the size of our economy. So now we're in this situation where we've got all this potential damage done. The Chinese are making calculations. We are not making the same kind of calculations with the input of with the understanding of a president. All the senior people and the economists and so on, trade experts,
right,
kind of understand what's going on.
Right.
The president does not. So there's always sort of this catch up. Does he understand the implications of what he's doing?
Yeah, but Dan
no,
Lipner,
not really.
Dan Lipner, you know, the interesting thing about this is Xinhua, the Chinese national news media outlet, or at least the preferred outlet of the Central Committee, talking about this, they said, quote, "This outcome is in line with the expectations of all parties. It took a step in the right direction of resolving China-U.S. economic and trade issues, serves the interests of the Chinese and American people, and is generally welcomed in the international community." Not once in that statement do they mention the words agreement or deal. Are we overselling this here in Washington, or are they playing three-dimensional chess in Beijing?
Yeah, whoa, Kemosabe. I don't know who this we is we're talking about. The president is absolutely trying to sell it. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, the fact that there's been so little given to him on this suggests that people in the know that the reason for all of this is because of his political issues that he wants to claim a win. And the Chinese, to their credit, why on earth would they want to dance around and potentially embarrass the president? They want to take their win quietly and walk away.
It could be. Rich Rubino,
I just wouldn't call it a win.
It's not a win.
But it's not that the Chinese won so much either. It's just there's not a lot there.
Well, if they got the postponement of any additional tariffs, that's a win.
Well,
and if the president doesn't have the political strength to go forward anyway, so if they want to essentially flatter him and say, yes, you know, you cut a great deal. And go, yeah, in 18 months, we're going to be dealing with a new president, assuming it's not.
It's an interesting question of whether postponing that 5% increase is a, quote, win for China or a win for the U.S. economy. Because many of us would argue that those tariffs are self-defeating and damaging to the U.S. economy. And I think the reason that the market responded positively to the Oval Office announcement and meeting was not because they thought, whoa, we've got ourselves a deal. It's...
Yeah, but this is
it's not an either or. We're in this horrible position that the market doesn't like in the first place. So postponing it's a win for the market.
But the market literally is going to be resilient in this long term. I mean, you're looking at it the way Donald Trump does.
Huh?
You're looking at... Hold on.
No, I was just taking issue with him saying that the Chinese got a win, and I don't see the win
what I'm saying is...
And we certainly didn't get any big win the way the president is trying to
this
portray
is
it.
This is a literally a which deal sucks less for who?
Well, no, it's not a deal. It's a little bit of progress. Look at what Mnuchin said. Even he, with his high level of loyalty to the president, said, yeah, there's not a lot of detail yet. And the Chinese didn't talk about a deal.
By the way, the left, you know, we always talk about the right wing conspiracy theorists. The left wing conspiracy theorists think that Mnuchin had pushed a Chinese deal because he's got movies in production in Chinese companies. Just so everybody knows, there are left wing.
Has he got Hunter Biden on his board yet?
Yeah, not yet. So, Rich Rubino, I mean, when we talk about the negotiation between Washington and Beijing, were a far cry from Nixon and Mao.
Oh, yeah.
Is there something that could be learned from how Richard Nixon dealt with Chairman Mao back in the day, economically, foreign policy-wise?
Well, I think that was a completely different... that was just such a different perspective, you know. In the case of Nixon and Mao... What Nixon did is essentially he opened up, he placated Mao, in terms of going over to meet with him, treating him with respect, and eventually he got to the point where President Carter essentially normalized relations with China. In this case, it's more about, obviously we have a certain relationship with China, and we're certainly dependent on them, if for no other reason than because of the part of the debt that they own, because they keep buying up our bonds, even though we owe a lot to ourselves as well. But no, I think it's a completely different perspective. I think now it's based more on economics, and it's also based a lot more here on domestic politics. That was based on geopolitics. It was based on trying to kind of split the Sino-Soviet relationship, and we were able to do that somewhat in terms of Nixon and Kissinger. But in this case, it's more about economics, and it's more about President Trump at home being able to declare that he got some sort of a win. And as Dan was talking about, in terms of the microeconomic phase, he has to somehow convince the farmers, the soybean farmers, he has to convince the people in Iowa and Minnesota and, in Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin that this was a win, that it was worth essentially going through this entire trade war, this entire conflict, and that there was light at the end of the tunnel. And the way Donald Trump sells things, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be true. It doesn't matter what the probity of it is. It's just a matter of the way that he sells it, and that's what that for Trump would be a victory. But no, this is more economics, not geopolitical.
you know, we keep talking about a deal, we keep talking about agreement, we keep talking about progress. Alan Moore, have we just basically, are we just punch drunk? Have we come to a stalemate and both sides are just looking for an on-ramp, an off-ramp that we could just...
I don't know. I think there are some important issues that have been discussed in great detail, and there was an outline of a potential deal that looked like it might actually be good for the U.S. without doing massive harm to China. And then the Chinese, this was many months ago now, and then the Chinese basically wanted to revise it. So they had their own second thoughts about it. And we're trying to get back sort of in that direction.
So what you're saying
without,
is...
But when we oversell and pretend that we got some great deal when we didn't, it maybe gets you a headline in the moment, but it's not the long term.
So what I'm hearing is that this is not the quote, unquote, greatest and biggest deal in economic history.
No, not even close.
By the Trump.
But I'll tell you what is a big deal, and you made reference to it earlier, and that is that we really do need to get the Congress to approve the U.S. Mexico-Canada agreement, the NAFTA 2, if you will, because NAFTA, the old NAFTA, is still in place, but it's going to expire the way this deal is set up. And it's not that I'm expecting that we'll find ourselves with no trade deal with those two countries, but that's an area that needs some concerted legislative attention. It's one of the things that a fair number of Democrats also understand, and there's at least a chance we may get that done still.
Has it passed either chamber?
No,
not yet. It hasn't even been brought up. But on that note, another subject for another time. On behalf of Alan Moore, Dan Lipner, Rich Rubino, Rob the Engineer kind of doing assistant producing today, and Charlie Burney doing Rob the Engineer type stuff. Thank you for your hospitality. Always good having you.
Lord help us.
Yeah, exactly. That by the way, that's what a Burney sounds like. Hey, you can follow us on Speaker. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook. You can listen to us on Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all of them. We're kind of a big deal now. Have a great week, America. We'll see you soon.